game site about nothing. The Kronk Games Podcast. In the mid-2000s, two nerds with a website tried to make it last. Welcome to the dance.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Game Site About Nothing, the Kronk Games Podcast. I am Ray Barnholt. With me is Alex Fraioli.
Hello.
Hello, Alex.
Hi, I can't believe you made me come into the office to do this.
Yeah, after 20 years.
Here we are in the Kronk compound. I can't believe the place is still here. Rather dusty.
Yes.
All of our old circa 2003 computer hardware is still here.
You left a banana out on the table, though. Jesus. Why'd you have to go and do that?
That's gross.
Anyway, this is the start of our new Patreon bonus series, and we're going to do something a little different for us, but also not that different at all, which is talk about ourselves incessantly. Are you ready for that?
Yeah. Y'all ready for this?
I suppose, though, that the different part is the subject, and that being an old video game news and review site we ran called Kronk Games at kronkgames.com.
Yes.
From about 2003 to 2006, but let's say only consistently for about a year. And then some things happened, and it kind of petered out. Now, just to be clear for everyone, this is not how Alex and I met, but it is a thing we did not too much longer after we met.
Yes, it was our first collaborative thing.
Yeah, and we will go into all of that. It absolutely is.
Yes.
It was our first collaborative thing. It is, you could say it is, you can blame Kronk Games for this. No More Whoppers.
Yeah, yeah.
And the title of this show, A Game Site About Nothing, is just a reference to a small little description of the site I wrote on the front page on the sidebar, and you know, it's still up there, by the way. The website is still up. I have no plans to take it down, so you can go to kronkgames.com. It'll live at least as long as we will, and so you can also use it to maybe follow along with the things that we will talk about over the course of this series. Wink, wink.
Ooh, interactive.
Yes. Oh boy, I have an interactive plan for sure. Now, as you may know, our first bonus show was recently finished. It was Gold in 16 Seconds.
That's right.
If you haven't heard it, here's a little recap.
He stole their gold. They want payback.
You try to crack my safe?
I don't do dogs. I had a bad experience.
What happened?
I had a bad experience.
The Italian job.
What happened to my gold?
We paid you the keys. Sneak preview Saturday.
And so that was a lot of fun.
What did happen to that guy's gold?
We didn't find out.
Edward Norton. Okay.
All right. You're right. We didn't figure. Oh my God. We never figured that out. We better go back and record it. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll do a second season.
You know
later.
What? Let's stop this right now. Let's go back and do another episode of Golden 16 Seconds. We got to finish it out. All right.
Okay.
The end. And that was also about 2003, but,
Is every bonus show we do going to be about 2003?
Well, this, you know, that one, it's a real manner of speaking to say it's about 2003. I think this time we'll be talking a lot more about what we were actually doing during that year, just in context that is less about, hey, this one commercial we saw when we were goofing around on the telephone together, and more like this is about being an adult and growing a career and that sort of stuff. And so 2003 plus a couple of years.
Yeah.
Now, there's no real super solid plan as to how many episodes there will be, maybe a little less than Gold in 16 Seconds, but with probably more meat to it anyway, I would say. But I wanted to kick things off with a sort of prologue with a bunch of stuff that I wanted to use to set the scene. Really. So,
Go for it.
Now, these prologues, almost none of it is about us or Kronk Games, but more like the environmental factors that led to it, I guess you could say. Because as we sit here right now talking about this in 2023, I would say that the notion of a video game website or even a news website in general is pretty much ruined, I guess is the easy way to put it.
Yeah.
The media landscape is effectively ruined. And the big media companies have never or will never in a million years ever understand the video game industry. And so their latest attempts to make money from editorializing it have been destroyed one way or another. And I think at this point you can almost count the number of active who you may want to call game journalists out there now on like two hands.
Yeah.
At least in the English speaking world, because it's the AI gold rush and search engine optimization is poisonous as ever. And there's basically no one on the other end who really cares about any of this editorial anyway, unless they want to pay a subscription to read it. And most aren't.
Yeah, I feel like all of this content, like all the things that we used to do, have now been relegated to like a select few people on Patreon.
Yep.
And if you want to read their writing about video games, you can pony up for them, to them, you know, buy them. FUBU.
Right. I think if we did Crunk Games now, if it was a website, it would be through Patreon, or it would probably just be a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
It's just, it can't be anything that, you know, would have any sort of commercial support behind it. And it never did, even back then. We never ran ads on it or anything, but.
No, it was just for fun.
Yeah, just for fun. Now, even if you want to have fun, you got to make some money. It's great, right? Anyway, we're here to talk about a pocket of time in this whole thing where we were a part of it, but also, I think, being affected by this ruination. Being affected by it without really realizing it. So now let us turn back the clock and see if we can't figure this all out, or at least figure ourselves out.
Okay.
And that means it's time for Internet Nostalgia from Millennials. Here we go. I want to take you back to the Y2K era.
Ooh.
The year 1999, 2000, 2001.
All right.
And the world of fan sites. Usually people, then or now, I think, you'd say the word fan site to them and they would think that to mean like Billy's South Park page on Angel Fire or whatever. Or Toaster Thief's Trigun page, you know, things like that.
Hey, wait a minute. Did I have a Trigun page?
Did you?
I was into Trigun and Cowboy Bebop. Those are my two big animes in the late 90s.
All right.
And I was still going by Toaster Thief. But no, do you want me to talk about my sites now?
Okay, yes. Yeah, go ahead.
All right.
Here.
I had two primarily. I had an Angel Fire site. I think that was angelfire.com/PA/Flansburg. And that was just a shrine devoted to Final Fantasy and bosses. That's right. All six of them.
That's right.
It was basically just a collection of big, beefy boss sprites, including for the games I hadn't played. And it was just me writing about, well, I bet this game's cool. Hope I can play it someday.
Yeah.
And then my other site, I had a GeoCities site. It was just a top to bottom Sephiroth shrine. It was just screenshots of every scene that Sephiroth is in the game and me writing about how cool he is. A year or two later, I started getting even more like hormonal and emotional and decided to make a counter shrine to Eris. Because of her sacrifice, man. Like, she was just the sweetest character. And I can't believe she's dead now.
Wait, what's a counter shrine?
That's a word I just made up. It's like, well, I have a Sephiroth shrine. I guess I should make an Eris shrine. Okay. So I made one about how sad it is that she died. And I think I deleted it after a month out of embarrassment. But quick aside, even back in like 97 or 98, I remember, like, when you're that age, when you're like 14, 15, and you're just discovering the internet, you think that you're bigger than you are.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? And I remember some foreshadowing. Our pal Andrew Vessel had a personal site hosted on SquareNet that was called Sephiroth's Domain, which was the name of my GeoCities site that I came up with independently. Oh, it's not a very original name. And I remember emailing him like, look, man, I know we have the same name for our sites, but – you know, I'll let you keep yours. It wasn't like threatening in tone, but it was like, I hope it's okay that mine has the same name. I really respect what you do, and I like your writing a lot. So, you know, I think there's room enough for both of us to exist here.
Well, there's also room enough to talk about Andrew Vestal and his sites that pretty much helped us get our start in a
That's
way.
Right.
And we will touch on that pretty soon.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I interrupt you though? Anything else?
No, that's it. Those were my two fan sites. And then in 99 was when I got my first domain, generalso.com, general-so.com.
Wow. Okay.
TSO, of course.
Yeah.
And that lasted a couple of years. That launched on January 1st, 2000.
Wow.
Like right at the stroke of midnight, it went live.
Beautiful. And it was beautiful orchestration there.
That was my blog and like media dump for all the rest of high school and even into college a little bit maybe.
Wonderful thing to be doing New Year's Eve 1999. Well, the world celebrating
Raymond
coming to the new millennium. Well, isn't it a wonderful cliche thing? I'm not even pointing a finger at you specifically. Just the idea of a nerd going like, I got to stay home and update my website.
No, I said it automatically. I wasn't there.
Oh, you could do it automatically?
Yes. Mm. I wrote everything beforehand. I uploaded everything beforehand. And I didn't even leave the house. My family and I just had a party at home anyway.
Okay. I'm not persecuting you.
I'm tired of being persecuted.
It's just a funny idea.
That was just a blog. And my buddy Smoo, whom we know, he used to make doodles in high school. He used to make funny drawings and write funny stories. And I would scan those and put those online because I thought they were hilarious. I'd write about crazy dreams I had, and I kept a diary when Brad and I
– A tradition
Brad
carried and I on to podcasting.
That's right. Brad and I waited in line at the PS2 launch. We got to Best Buy at 4 a.m., and I started keeping like a journal as we waited in line for hours.
Yeah.
And then I got home, transcribed it, uploaded it, so you can read about us waiting in line at a Best Buy in 1999.
All right.
Very fun. GeneralSo.com eventually became Patui.com. There might have been a Patui.net in there somewhere. Now it's Patui.org.
All right. Next up, Patui.edu.
No, I can't afford that. I did. I briefly also had because when I was at Ohio University, they give every student web space. I was actually class where you have to design a homepage. Basic ass computer science.
Yeah, that's
course.
Really how homepages came to be, is because, you know, all these networks in the early internet were all universities essentially. And so they were just giving all the students username web pages and
check out my homepage. Yep. That was brief. But yeah, that's my history, the history of Al sites.
All right. Well, my big website, I don't know if I really started out on GeoCities necessarily, but I had a website called the NES Wormhole.
Oh, wow.
It was one of several billion NES fan pages, and I ended up just turning it in. I think it might have been a GeoCities type situation at first, but then I moved it onto an actual like web host.
Oh, wow.
Like a subdomain and everything. And because cool. It was just a way to store reviews and views and different ways of me being funny, trying really hard to be funny about NES games and stuff, and like scanning a couple of the Nintendo comics I had because that hadn't been on there. And yeah, I ran that probably again for another year or two. Yeah, and in between that, I was being a little shithead on emulation forums and things, just causing people to not like me and then my site and all that. And, it didn't work out after that. But
is it true that you originated the famous catchphrase, de-interlace these nuts?
I'm afraid not. What does that even
– okay.
What?
No, you would just – it was your signature on the forums.
Yeah. I was also 14. Yeah. I didn't know what de-interlacing was.
Oh, okay.
What are you talking about?
I don't know. I'm trying to riff on what you're saying.
Okay, good. that was really about it, though. I think I might have had a little side tripod page thing after that.
Oh, my God. I forgot about tripod.
Yeah, well, tripod, Angel Fire, GeoCities, all these places that we give you
Simpatico.
5 to 10 megabytes. Okay, sure. Yeah, Simpatico.
Yeah.
Or maybe even your ISP actually gave you like the little username web space to put them in. But yeah, the main thing was the NES site. And like, again, a thing with a host that I was like paying money for, my mom's money, but like basically just a bunch of silly things made all through Microsoft Front Page, because that's what I like to do in general, have WYSIWYG software to make anything creative,
because
I'm not going to learn actual programming.
See, I did. That's as far as I got, is I taught myself HTML. I did everything in Notepad.
Right.
And I got so into it. No, I loved it. I got really into it, but I got so into it that I was like, oh shit, this is real fun and real easy. And HTML is cool. And I could do this as a job. Maybe I want to study web design. And then a couple of years later, like I learned about CSS and Java and other shit. And I'm like, I'm not learning more than one of these. And I immediately lost all interest in web design.
Yeah. Oh.
Like if it was just HTML, I'd be like, yeah, this is fun. This is easy. I can do this. And then it's like, no, you got to learn all this other shit too. Well, I don't feel like it then.
And now everything is like 12 times more serious than that even. So
yeah.
CSS and JavaScript are like baby toys. Yeah, because everything has to be an app now. Everything has to be responsive. Everything has to be calling a back end, et cetera, et cetera.
Cool.
And, because they need to serve more and more ads and the cookie warnings. Do you accept our cookies? Of course you do.
I guess.
Yeah, oh, God, you're, well, okay. You're going to click it because you want the damn thing to stop covering up the lower third of the website, right? So,
well, I mean, if there's like an X, I'll always opt for the X instead of agree.
Right.
But if there's no X, I will reluctantly hit agree.
Yeah. But that's the thing with the cookies. It's like you either accept everything or you make your cookie preferences, and then you go into a submenu that's like, oh, only the necessary cookies, please. Or no, you can have the tracking cookies. I don't mind, you know, things like that. That was anyway, that's our internet profile.
We're not counting blogging sites like LiveJournal, right? Because we were pretty active, or at least I was pretty active on those as well.
No, I'm really talking like late 90s, right up to 2000. So okay. I think LiveJournal was a little bit after this, more in the 2001, 2002 era. I know LiveJournal was around a bit longer than that. There was another, there was another journaling site before that. I completely forget the name of it, but it was another independent thing that some of my friends on IRC had been using, and God dang it, I forget the name entirely. It was much, much smaller scale outfit. But yeah, that stuff was all over. So you had fan sites for everything, of course, as we sort of intimated. But in terms of video games, I think especially at this time, what we started to see more of in the 2000s, right around the PS2 was out, and people like you and Brad were standing in line. What came about, I think, was more of what I would call semi-pro fan sites, or, you know, aspirational sites, aspirational sorts of press outlets. Because prior to all this, you weren't seeing much like concentrated editorial on a small scale, because it was all the big media companies providing their game product. CNET had like Game Center. There was Nuke for EGM, and GameSpot was also part of like Ziff Davis and EGM until they split off. And then the IGN and their own Imagine Network sites, and all the PC gamer stuff, Game Players, Next Generation and Edge, and Game Fan, you know, all the big magazines that we knew about all pretty much had their own websites or separate editorial teams working on a website network that was just like part of the dot-com boom, and I suppose. And I think a lot of us, the fans and the readers, sort of accepted that, and there wasn't any like new money coming in, so to speak. And again, I'm not talking about right at 2000. You know, this is the internet boom age, 97-ish up to 99. So before 2000, I think the big independent game sites were more centered around stuff like downloads and news feeds and other automatic sort of thing, and cheats and facts, and or just like multiplayer web gaming services than really concentrating on editorial stuff. It was like the magazines will do the editorial stuff on the web. Anything else that is like a game focused thing will just do files and all the other things that you would do to, if you wanted video game information.
And I did.
An interesting example of that, though, was GameSpy, because GameSpy started out as like an app to find multiplayer servers. But then they also created an editorial wing. And so GameSpy.com was like this hybrid of multiplayer service and editorial site.
I did not know that. I did freelance for GameSpy for a couple of years.
Yeah, you never used the GameSpy app?
No, I had no idea.
Yeah, no, it was like a huge thing. It turned into like this big, it was like a free app you would download, and it would help you find Quake servers or Duke Nukem servers or whatever.
Wow.
Yeah, that's why it's called GameSpy, because you were seeking out servers. And so to go back to my point, it seemed like the next-gen consoles at around 99-2000 were providing more ambition to fans, I think, to sort of start up their own sorts of outlets. And so you had these semi-pro sites who were being started by people who could actually write and have things like deductive skills. And at the very least, you know, they want to or could pull off coming off as legitimate. And, you know, they could be journalistic stuff, but not necessarily journalism. But of course, that helps. I mean, you know, it's just a melange of different sort of thing. Now, this will lead into talking about the GIA, and that was one of those places, although it started in 98. But I mean, there was even larger examples than that. I'm thinking about places that wanted to be like IGN, but didn't have the scale, didn't have the people or money to do it. Planet GameCube or Team Xbox. I don't remember a proper PlayStation 1, but these sites that just came up around the next generation coming up and just being devoted to each platform. I don't know if you visited any of these, Alex, but
no, I don't think I did.
All right.
Not really.
So I guess did you stick to the big boys then?
You know what? I don't even remember. I think that once I discovered the GIA, that was my only source for news, because they covered the genres that I cared about. Everything else was just fluff. Like, I don't care about
racing games or whatever. GIA was like, here's RPGs, puzzle games, some survival horror. Like, oh yeah, that's me.
Yeah, we'll get into that. That's all I need. Now.
Also, GIA had a voice, and the other sites kind of didn't. It was all just like, it looks like the sequel's going to have better graphics. Stay tuned for more updates. Yeah. Okay, cool. Thanks. Yeah, really
we'll get there. We'll get there.
All right.
How about before that? Like, what was, like, the big sites you remember going to?
I guess IGN was the only one.
Yeah.
Because I remember writing into their letters column pretty frequently as well and getting published a few times just talking about video games.
But IGN back then was also split off into, like, platform sites. There was PSX Power and N64.com.
No.
And then they sort of, I guess, quickly joined into IGN proper, but yeah.
The Voltron IGN, I guess, was the one that I was writing to.
All right. Well, I was just asking, too, because I know we read a lot of game players, and I guess, you know.
Oh, yeah. Again, that's the coverage that had a voice, and so it was interesting to me.
I think also, though, that company, I think it was Imagine as well. Game Players was Imagine eventually. And PC Gamer, like, they were pumping out CD-ROMs, and they were still doing this for, you know, in the middle of the internet stuff, coming out with a monthly CD-ROM with each issue of the magazine. And some of that would have, like, not just videos of games and things, but also, you know, some peeks into the editorial office and stuff.
I was always pissed off because, like, if you paid for a Game Player subscription, which I did for years, you would get every issue, including the special subscribers newsletter.
Right.
If you remember those, like in the middle, there'd be like an aquamarine, you know, extra thick sheet of paper.
Monochrome.
Like, here's a letter from the editor. Yeah. Here's some jokes on it. Like, it was cool. And so it was supposed to come with a CD. I never got any of the CDs.
I don't think I did either.
Oh, really? Did they just not go out to everybody?
I don't remember getting a lot of Game Players CDs. Yeah, no.
I remember being kind of pissed off because they said that, hey, our CD this month for subscribers is just Christmas Nights, the whole game. Here you go.
Yeah, they also did that with Next Generation. So I did buy an issue of Next Generation that came with Christmas Nights.
The first time I actually got my hands on a Game Players CD was from a friend's subscription.
Yeah.
And I popped it in excitedly, and it spoiled FF7 for me.
All right.
They just ripped the CG cutscenes from the game and put them on, or not all of them, but they put some of them, including Aeris' death scene, on their bonus disc. Like, here's some scenes from this cool game that's coming out. Oh, that seems like a big spoiler.
Then you were inspired to make your shrine?
Well, no, that was after the game came out and I played it.
Okay. But it stayed fresh in your mind.
Yes.
Of course. You were sad about Aeris the entire time.
Yes.
Okay. Well, yeah. I guess, I never got the Game Player CD. I got some PC Gamer CDs, but I didn't subscribe to it. I just picked it up eventually. But I do remember wanting to get Christmas Nights and had to go to Barnes & Noble to buy an issue of Next Generation to actually get it.
Oh, boy.
And was it worth it? You be the judge.
It's festive.
Yeah. Merry Christmas, everybody.
When are they doing a modern HD remaster of Christmas Nights?
Well, they sort of did. I believe it's in the modern versions, yes.
Oh, is it? I didn't even know that. Okay. Yeah. I was just being flippant.
Yeah.
All right.
So screw you. No, I'm sorry. That was too mean.
Oh.
So going back to like these sort of semi-pro sites, I don't remember really how good their writing was at the beginning. Because like you, I wasn't really going to these places. But I think it's safe to say there were ambitious people behind them. And some of those people got placed into the big leagues. I think Planet GameCube was ran by Billy Berghammer, and he just ended up working for Nintendo.
Oh, wow.
I think he's still there. And other various people. But there are some smaller examples of these sorts of semi-pro things, and I think a lot of it was sort of, in some cases, born out of people who were already doing like zines, video game zines in their house and stuff. So one example would be our friend Matt Leone.
Oh, yeah.
He had a newsletter that he turned into a site called Event Gaming. He was covering mostly arcade stuff. That was his beat and, you know, fighting games, that sort of thing. And so, you know, whatever news about that would pop up, he would be there to do it. And, of course, he ended up very soon just joining one up and being sort of a founding member there, I believe. And
yes, with me. Well, not physically with me. I had a phone call with him right after 1UP launched. We were, because I think he was still, he had some relation to doing news. I was all news because I was a freelancer. Freelance for life, which means mostly news and sometimes other stuff.
Yeah, we'll go into that.
For me, I was, I think, at my parents' house in New Jersey at the time. We were coordinating on some news stuff because there was a lot of news that day or something.
And then we were just making conversation. I remember he was saying, this is really cool. I'm really happy to be here. I think this is a cool way to kind of start my career in video game writing. And I think I said something like, I'm trying to get out of this. I remember being like, because at that point I had given up. I was about to graduate college. I think I'd already been, I was still a year or two out, but I was like, I don't think this industry is so hot anymore. And like, I think I'm just going to go to Japan and teach English and I'm trying to get out of this. And he's like, no, man, it's great. I'm having fun. There's still a lot to do. I don't know if I was like jaded or disappointed or what, but I was like, that was kind of the beginning of my start. It was just starting to kind of lose my wide-eyed idealism in regards to writing about video games was around that time. But Matt Leone is one of the actual people, like, you know, that I think video game journalist is a fake term that means nothing because it's an enthusiast press and you're not doing journalism. He is one of the actual guys doing journalism. He's one of the guys who is flying to Japan and doing interviews to write about Street Fighter 2 and Final Fantasy 7 and gather actual information. Like when Gamergate chuds say they hate video game journalists, they're not talking about real ones like Matt Leone. They're talking about people who write reviews, you know, that they don't like.
Yeah. No, that's very nice. I can agree with that. Matt always had a big interest in the actual developers behind games and stuff and always wanted to get inside stories and things like that. So, yeah, that's just how it evolved. But he started out doing these sorts of little news things, you know, again, born out of his zine.
Did you ever subscribe to any zines? I subscribed to some girl. I thought she was – I found out about her through Game Players. She put out an RPG, JRPG zine that I thought was cool.
No, I never did.
No?
I guess they didn't grab me. I guess because I already had the magazines and so.
And I think I contributed a Silent Hill 2 review to Jeremy Parrish's Toasty Frog zine in 2001 or 2.
All right.
Good stuff.
Yeah. So in terms of like what we'll, you know, what we'll tell the story about the GIA eventually, but yeah. You do it. You had more of a connection to some of the early people than I think I did.
Yeah, because at least Jeremy posted on the RP Gamer. So there was a message board, the RP Gamer Final Fantasy series message board, or RPG FFSMB, where me, that's where I first met Jeremy. This is probably I don't know, when did Andrew sell? He sold SquareNet to Mike Tidwell, and then it became RP Gamer?
Yep, I don't remember the year.
Yeah, but it was... I guess mid to late 90s. The message boards were broken up into series, and there was one just for all of Final Fantasy. And I'm like, well, that's my favorite series. I'm going to make this my home. And that's where I met Jeremy. This was 97, 98, I guess. And he was posting in GIA launched in 98, right? He was posting in around that time about, hey, I'm working on this new site. I'm doing web design for it. Here's some of the cool people involved. Andrew Vessel's going to be involved. And I just remember getting real excited for it.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that was not me, but yeah. Okay, we'll get into that. And also, one of the things, you know, we mentioned sort of being a part of the founding part of 1UP. And we'll get into that too, because in the middle of doing the Crunk Game stuff, like I said, we were trying to make a little bit of a career for ourselves and trying to get some freelance work and things like that. And so that is sort of a side chapter to everything, but I think it does play into a lot of what we'll be talking about. So that'll be a little bit later. Now, you know, I don't have an exhaustive list of any of these other sorts of smaller semi-pro sites or anything. I don't even know exactly how you could even compare all of them to the GIA or even Crunk Games, what we did before.
Did you know I was involved in a GIA-inspired site in like 2000? I think it was called Gold Saucer.
Okay.
And it was like me and a bunch of guys from IRC.
I didn't know this. No.
Yeah. Like we had an actual domain and everything. And we were just like, we're the GIA's little brother. We're going to do, we basically just tried to copy everything they did and failed at it because most of us were just not good writers. Well, and I was not a good writer at the time either.
Okay. Well, it would serve you well for Crunk Games, I guess.
Yeah.
Because we did end up mocking the GIA a bit more.
Oh, did we?
Well, a little bit. We copied it a bit at the beginning. Not like fully. Right. We'll get into it. But yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Again, I don't know every single sort of little site that was going on. I guess one of the better examples I can come up with right now would be Insert Credit, which is still around.
Oh,
I think
yeah.
They started a bit earlier, to like 2001 or something. But yeah, their whole thing was like more sorts of long form articles or meteor sorts of reviews that were very honed towards the staff's specific tastes. And that is really the point I want to make, is that there were a lot of sites that were very geared towards someone's taste, and we were a part of that eventually as well. But also even the GIA, yes, like you mentioned, was very focused on basically, you know, a couple of genres, mainly RPGs, but, you know, whatever else that sort of RPG group of RPG likers would be into, related to that.
And I feel like when you are looking for someone to read, it's like looking for critics. It's like, if you like a film critic, you probably like them because you have similar taste in movies and you can trust their takes on films. It's the same with video games. It's, you know, you read people that you share interests with.
Right.
And this goes, you know, this applies site-wide as well. And so the GIA was just a perfect mix of, oh, I like pretty much all this stuff. I like all these personalities. And like I said earlier, it was a voice. They had a voice, whereas all the mainstream sites were more – I mean, sometimes they had a voice, but it was mostly just, here's the new trailer for Gun Guy 4. Look at these high-res graphics. And then sometimes you'd go to like the mailbag section for – a voice, which is where I would usually hang out, but otherwise it was just, I've just found them very sterile, very boring. Smaller sites have a voice and a you know, a focus.
Right.
Focus is great,
but then, you know, where is that now? I guess YouTube is like an easy answer. But you
YouTube
have to
and
go
Patreon,
searching
yeah.
for it, like, okay, what if I'm into a Toho game? Well, I'm going to search the new Toho game on YouTube, but maybe I'll find someone who covers Toho games a lot, or maybe not. But are they still going to be good? Are they going to sound bad? Are they just not good at writing their own scripts, that sort of thing? And so
that's the thing.
A whole different
is
problem.
That's where we are right now in terms of like video game quote unquote coverage in 2023, is there is coverage for everything, but the quality varies.
Right.
So I think that's like, hey, if you're looking for YouTube content to do, find something that is being done, but is just still being done poorly, and kind of give it the attention that it deserves.
Yes.
You know,
and this goes right into my next point, which that even back then, though, these sites that we're talking about, there was a flip side of like websites and blogs that had people operating in what I would just call like school essay mode, where they're pretending to be like a real news site and using all that they learned in English class to sound like an adult, but it just doesn't quite work. You know,
they're using the wrong words.
They're reporting on only on what's in front of their face, not doing any extra research or prior knowledge. Just, you know.
Yeah.
And like we were saying, we still get sites, or more accurately, you know, content creators who are like this, who operate below average and appeal to below average brains. And if you're looking for something specific, is that going to hit it for you? Probably not. But it's the only thing you can find.
That is, again, I think we're gonna touch a few times on Gamergate shows. But that is another, like, that's what I think one of the reasons they're so bitter towards video game quote unquote journalists is because a lot of people that we knew writing about games did know how to write and did have a voice, and it's just something that like gamer bros never bothered to cultivate. But they think, I'm good at video games, I deserve that job. No, you don't.
Right.
Because you're good at games. You're missing the two more important facets of the job, which are know how to write and know how to deal like socially with other people in a work environment. And I don't think you can do either of those.
Yeah.
This is coming from personal experience, because I knew a Gamergate dude who was like super bitter that he couldn't get a job writing about games. He was just angry, vitriolic, hated everybody and everything, and then wondered why no one liked him. Gee, I don't know.
Gee, who knows? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had my bitterness, and we'll talk about it maybe, but I think back on those things, and I look at also these sorts of bitter people you're talking about, and I just, at the end of the day, I am still glad that I did have above average writing skills, at least in school, you know, doing very well with papers and things like that, to the point where, yes, I could see myself successfully doing that about games, and then having an actual interest in games that would then foster this little thing called deductive reasoning and critical thinking, where you know, that helps you also write these things. And there is a whole lot of that missing in this sort of average content pool.
And I mean, I was kind of that way as well when I was young.
And I would credit, honestly, I'd credit Crunk Games, and I'd credit the GIA and Crunk Games, but more so Crunk Games, really, with teaching me that it's okay to lean into your voice.
Okay, yeah.
And this is a tip for anybody who does anything creatively. Don't do what you think you're supposed to do. Do the thing that you would want to see or read, you know?
Yes.
Because so much, like you said, like I was operating in SA mode for like my early teen years writing about video games.
Right.
And then I'd read, you know, Jeremy Parrish's stuff in the late 90s and I'd be like, oh, this guy's more interesting than I am. Why is that? He seems smarter. He seems to know what he's talking about. But some of this is really funny. Some of this is, you know, it's also very informative. Like even now in my life, if I'm doing something new or if I'm working with someone new, my default mode is do what you think you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'll do that from anywhere from a day to a year. And eventually I will hit a point. I'll hit a breaking point where I get sick of it and I'll just snap out of it. And then I'll start doing the thing for real.
Okay. Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know why that is, but like, I guess it's a comfort thing. I get comfortable enough in a job where I'm like, oh, I can like do it for real now. I don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I experienced that was with Crunk Games, was where I could write about anything I wanted. I could lean into my voice. I didn't have to write things super seriously.
Sure. Yeah.
It can be fun. Things can be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then maybe in our case, we throw around a few too many slurs, but that's also another topic.
It was a different time.
Well, believe me, we'll cover it. But no, yeah, you're totally right. And honestly, I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that. I didn't really. I just didn't have a concept that you thought that way about us doing that site.
Yes. I mean, I think that other people figured that out independently, but the difference is that the vast majority of people who figure that out take it to mean, oh, I also need to sound like the angry video game nerd. And they just kind of lean into anger when like, no, guys, anger is pretty well covered. It's pretty well-trod territory.
No,
I don't think we need –
I'll be the happy video game nerd.
Oh, you're Mr. Happy Gaming.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. He does good FF14 guides, though, on YouTube.
Okay.
That's a real guy. Yeah.
All right.
Anyway.
Kudos to him. Shout out.
Yeah. shout out to Mr. H.
Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, this is nothing we have a lot of direct experience in, but yeah, that early YouTube stuff is like just history repeating itself with the sorts of things that we're talking about with these sites. Like one person gets really good at it and everybody else follows. And yeah, there's no voice. Where's the voice? It's just doing that over and over again. It's a bunch of kids just repeating it ad infinitum until it just peters out and until you're left with the one guy who still did it the best way.
Yeah. And then I think the other side of that is like there's angry video game nerd like style. But then the counter to that is nostalgia critic style,
yes.
Which I hate, and you can tell, you instantly know when you fire up a YouTube video if this nerd was inspired by Nostalgia Critic, because 9 times out of 10, it starts with them just staring blankly at the camera in silence and then saying something like, really?
Yes, or you know a big sigh at the beginning too.
yes, big sigh at the beginning. Can you believe this is so bad?
I can't believe here we are covering Final Fantasy Mystic Quest. Finally made it.
Jeez, you really seem to not be enjoying this, man. Your bio says you love video games, but
the game that ruined my childhood. Boy, here we go with the story, I guess.
Yeah, the game that ruined my childhood is like that's your mandatory first video.
Yes.
It has to be. It's like presenting your doctoral thesis. Like you have to present it to a committee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone on social media wrote some sort of post that mocking that whole thing too, where it was just like the typical video of that also was like the evil version of the guy appears is like, no, don't make me do it. Don't make me review Sonic 06.
Oh, man. Oh, that's so true.
Yeah.
Cool.
Kind of glad though I was also there to see that sort of rise up and be like, oh boy, well, you kids have fun.
This is actually analogous to my approach to stand-up comedy as well, because you see this in like the most popular kinds of stand-up comedy, like the stuff with the most appeal is, I don't want to say lowest common denominator, but it kind of is. It's like Larry the Cable Guy, it's like,
oh yeah,
My wife is dumb and I fart a lot. Don't take that as a drop.
How about just the second part? Just the fart part.
But the stuff that I do like is like Paul F. Tompkins, which is a lot of like, it's more long form story and anecdotes. And there are stories. I think he did once describe his comedy as, I do Paul F. Tompkins based content. Because it's just experiences okay. and stories that sure. come from him.
Boy, what an egomaniac.
It's not, no, but it's like, it's the counter to like mundane observational comedy. Because observational comedy, especially as I get older, observational comedy gets worse and worse. It just seems more and more boring to sure. me. Because anytime I see an observational joke anymore, it's like, oh yeah, I guess that's a common American opinion. Oh, is this because you've never been outside of your town? Oh, is this because you've never met a black person? Like you've got the most mundane opinions that you project onto the world because yours is so tiny.
Yeah.
And it's the most boring shit.
And then, you know, the stereotype of observational comedy became, you know, basically what we joke about now, the 80s comedy yeah. boom, the standing in front yes. of a brick wall guy doing yeah. these lame observational jokes all the time. And so
yeah.
that evolved too. And I think the YouTube stuff yes. we're talking about, it's just like, it's become just a part of someone's culture or youth rather that it just, you know, eventually you grow up and it's like, boy, that kind of sucked. But well, yeah, I sure did see yeah. a lot of it.
I think it was even before like I discovered podcasts, really, it was Patton Oswalt who set that off for me. Cause I got some of his stand-up albums and I'm like, wow, this guy is like, he's not just telling jokes. He's got like stories, but they're funny and they're relatable.
Right.
And it's more than like, that's when I started to make the comparison between alternative comedy and Japanese Rakugo, which is just long form storytelling.
Yeah.
I wrote an article for a local magazine, Nag Mag, years ago about Rakugo and its similarities to, you know, American stand-up comedy, specifically that kind of narrative-driven alternative comedy. Yeah, and I can't go back now. I can't, like, anytime I see, like, a stand-up special on Netflix, I'm like, oh, I'll try it out. And then 5 minutes in, it's just a different iteration of my wife is dumb and I fart a lot. And I'm like, oh, I can't watch this.
Yeah, movie. There's a ton of that on Netflix.
Yeah. But yeah, and yeah, that's exactly the state of like talking about video games on YouTube as well. Is there's a vast majority that's just, you know, my evil twin making me review Sonic 06.
Yeah.
And then, you know, 1% well thought out, interesting pieces.
Yes. And then to go back to my example with, you know, the websites that we're talking about contemporarily, like just plain blogs of kids just trying to write news or
yeah.
just parrot it all, right? My main thing in talking about the fan sites was trying to find that middle ground between, you know, the big guys who are getting paid to write maybe mediocre stuff, but also the independent people who were not getting paid to write about things that they actually liked. So, so now we get a little bit closer to actually talking about me and Alex. And basically, Alex and I don't meet without a website called the Gaming Intelligence Agency or the GIA.
That's right.
Which is where we got brought on as writers. But we also don't get to the GIA without a bunch of stuff happening before that. And so let's go ahead with a story that I have no right to tell, but it'll be vague and brief anyway. But
okay.
And you've already touched on it, of course. There was, of course, before the GIA, there was the unofficial Squaresoft homepage by Andrew Vestal, which then did transform into SquareNet, Square.net, whatever.
And that was hosted on Square's official servers at the time.
Yeah, not at the beginning, but yeah. They did like invite him on. But yeah, he started that in like 1995, and it was just, you know, a sort of hub for Japanese RPG nerds.
Yes.
And it was just whatever could have been relevant. So it was a lot of news posts, of course, you know, stuff from Japan or updates on what was coming out in America, a lot of media like screenshots and scans, I think music and videos too, wherever that was possible. And
yeah, I remember he even there were a lot of editorials, and he wrote one sort of, you know, asking Square, please don't censor Xenogears when you bring it over, because it's got a lot of potentially censorable stuff.
Yeah,
which like that's a very different kind of thing to write about in 1998 versus 2023, because now the word censorship kind of has a different meaning. And when gamers clamor about censorship, they don't necessarily mean the same thing they meant in 1998.
Yeah, that's for sure.
You know, yeah.
Not sure I want to touch on all that.
No,
at least in the modern sense. Ugh,
but yeah, I was, I don't know if I was online in 95. I don't think I got online until 96, and it was at a friend's house where I remember going to a friend's house. He had AOL, and he had just downloaded this new game called Final Fantasy V with the English patch.
Oh, boy.
We played that for a
while. Yeah, that might have been 97 or 8.
Oh, really? Was it finally, that late?
Well, when they finally released it, yeah.
Oh, wow, okay. Then it must have been, yeah. And I remember I weirded him out because we'd like, it was my first exposure to AOL and the internet. And I'm just like in a chat room. And yeah. And I think I ended up, folks, there was a thing we used to call cyber sex, which was not actually sex,
no.
But it was actually, it was a word-based version.
I got to go.
And I think he went to the bathroom and I just started, I was like, I think I was role-playing a girl. Cyber sexing, what I assume was a guy.
Sure.
At I guess I was 14. You're still figuring yourself out at that age.
Okay. Yeah.
I was so entranced by this internet thing that I even like asked him, "Hey, can I use your AOL login at home?" He's like, "Yeah, sure."
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And then I think a few months later, we actually got there was a local ISP we signed up with.
Wow. So you really had no concept of it before, like the 97 or whatever.
I did, but I hadn't seen the practical applications of it. I didn't understand. Okay. I just heard internet and I just thought like, oh, it's, you can access information. What does that mean to a 14-year-old? You know, it doesn't mean anything. And then I go to my friend's house and I see I can do a cyber sex. I can go to this anime shrine. I can get video game news. I can get screenshots for games that aren't out yet. And then at another buddy's house, at Brad's house once, I remember, again, I was still in my, like, internet honeymoon phase. I was just up until 4 a.m. looking at anime fan sites. Just not even porn. Just like, here's some cool anime you can check out. Here's some that's coming out soon on VHS. and I was online for so long, I got disconnected. And it's 4 a.m. I'm 14 or 15. I don't want to go to bed. I want to read more about anime. So I wake Brad up. And I say, hey, what's your password for your ISP? And he's like, I don't know. And then I'm like, okay, well, who does know? He's like, my dad. So we wake up his dad at 4 a.m. so that I can ask him, what's the password to your ISP? This guy has work in the morning.
Yeah.
This guy has to go to work in like 2.5 hours. And he's just like, Alex, it's 4 a.m. Go to bed. And then
I do. Okay.
I'm only now getting comfortable talking about what an asshole I was as a teenager. There will be more of that later.
For sure. But anyway, back to the
Squaresoft
homepage.
Kind of got in the weeds there. But yeah, unofficial Squaresoft homepage or SquareNet was one of my first loves when we actually did get an ISP.
So it is actually fully archived. Andrew Vestal does have it still up. You can go to squaresoft.thegia.com to look at the last possible version of it, I suppose, dated from November 96. And yeah, you can just go around and here, like I click on the What's New link and here's a bunch of MIDI music and here's some stuff from Final Fantasy III and Chrono Trigger and pictures of stuff from Saga Frontier, you know, and the whole sidebar, the whole frame sidebar of things is just like Final Fantasy games, other Squaresoft games, Japanese Squaresoft games, Squaresoft information, and then miscellaneous. And
that's something. Yeah. There's just something about the heading at Japanese Squaresoft games that makes my brain like freeze up. Like, what do you mean? Wait a minute. Come on. Shut up.
Have you heard of these? Bushido Blade.
Cool.
Something called Live Alive.
Cool.
Romancing Saga 1, 2, and 3.
Wow.
Rudra's Secret Treasure. I don't think that was the actual proper translation. Saga Frontier. Seiken Densetsu 3. You may know it as Secret of Mana 2.
I do.
And Tobal the First. Yeah, and of course, he even kept the About page with a picture of him as a very teenaged version.
Wow.
And just the whole bio is there and everything. Like I said, this is 95, pretty early. Just as, you know, kind of perceptive that, you know, a lot of people would be wanting this kind of information because the PlayStation, I think, had just come out in America, and you know, we were already hearing things about all the new Squaresoft stuff and how you know, Chrono Trigger at the time was coming out and stuff like that. And so, you know, as the years went on and this sort of information grew and things would not come out in America and things like Final Fantasy VII would get announced, like, you know, people would become more rabid for that information. And so here was the unofficial Squaresoft homepage to keep you as up to date as possible on some of that stuff, along with any other sorts of, you know, message boards or chat rooms you may have been in. And so, like I said, it was just that big hub for the RPG nerd. And that did, yeah, then become transformed into SquareNet, kind of the same thing, but a little bit more involved in terms of, like, you know, more, I think, editorial coverage as well. And Andrew Vessel eventually did sort of let that whole thing go, I think, as it was getting too big and voluminous for his progressing life, you know, because he was just heading into college or already in college at the time. And so, yeah, like you said, basically sold it off. And that site then became
RP Gamer. Well, yeah, it was. Well, Smoo called it RPG Aimer, but I always said RP Gamer because it's you know it's like saying pin number. You don't. It's you know.
Yes, yes, yes. ATM machine.
I don't. Think, yeah. I don't Same think thing, so.
Yeah. Absolutely. yeah, that is that's still up, right? RP Gamer still going.
I believe they're still going. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just the same sort of concept, just carried on today. Just trailers and new media and reviews and everything on newest RPGs that people.
Is Mike Tidwell's son like a metal guy? I think I came across a dude on YouTube doing Final Fantasy metal covers with the name Tidwell.
I don't know much about that whole part of the thing. I don't know anything about Mike Tidwell.
I just remember it was very contentious. Like, Andrew sold off the site to him, and then I think immediately regretted it because he was kind of a jerk, Tidwell.
Okay. See, I don't
there was
have
some drama there.
Much concept of any of this drama. That's why I'm saying, like, I don't have much of a right to tell the story, but I'm keeping it vague to sort of give people the historical overview. If you have any insight on it, please go ahead. But, yeah.
Well, this is the bonus show, which means we can just say anything. We can make shit up. I saw Andrew strangle a giraffe.
Okay, well, this is the public prologue. So this is going to be going out to our normal.
Hi, everybody.
I had the photos.
they are, of course, in portrait mode.
Oh, Lord. Okay.
Giraffes are tall.
To skip ahead. Yes, after RP Gamer, Andrew Vestal then would sort of iterate that into a new concept of a site called the GIA, and that would be launched in November of 1998, right on time for Zelda Ocarina of Time. I think they launched like the day of or day after because they had a review ready already or something like that.
Oh, wow. It's already ready already.
And so the scope had been broadened because I think it was a bit more news-focused, but I mean, it was still JRPG focused, but anything else notable, right? Like anything else that Andrew or the rest of the staff would be into. And that would include, like, again, a lot of Japanese stuff, the cool stuff coming in from Japan or, and then that included like scoops from Japan. And so they had a bit more going on than just like a media dump of any new RPG stuff. This was like,
yes,
a real, like I was saying before, this is like a real amateur sort of outlet.
Yes. And a lot of that appeal to me was obviously the coverage was appealing because they were games and genres that I was interested in, but they were also, as far as I knew, the only site that would just upload like, hey, here's 12 minutes of Japanese commercials that we just got off TV. And
right.
Nobody else was doing that.
And Andrew was just talking about that, I think a year or two ago, because he was on Retronauts talking about old websites like his, and the story I remember is that he had an acquaintance in Japan who was way into like J-pop and recording like all the music shows, but also, you know, in the midst of that, like hoovering up all these commercials, including ones for games, and he would just say to Andrew, hey, you want some clips of these commercials? And you'd be like, yes.
Oh,
and
cool.
That sort of became, yeah, like a defining thing that you would go to the GIA for, was to look at, you know, this new Japanese media commercials because no one else was uploading it.
Yeah.
No one else was really going to the lengths to do it. You would just get like plain text reporting on, hey, what was announced or whatever.
Yeah.
Here was at least like some cultural insight into what was actually going on in the Japanese gaming industry.
Yeah. They also had a huge scoop on FF9 before anybody else did. I think because Andrew had a lot of friends at Squaresoft.
Very gigantic.
That was incredible. Yeah. Like they got access to like art, like character designs.
Yes. A ton of art that looked nothing like FF9 turned out. Really?
Yeah.
Some characters that might look like one or another, but just complete like concepts of things that never really came to fruition. Insane and very high quality, like probably just taken right off a hard drive. Just ridiculous. And then, yeah, again, I don't really know all the drama that might have occurred because of that, because we came a bit later. But yeah, just a real fun sort of thing as a reader, as an observer. Oh yeah, and one other thing that might not have been big on the Squaresoft homepage was like community angles. So they had a letters column and art and fanfic sections, and so and a forum. And so people were brought in from many different angles to sort of share their love for this stuff. And I think that was also kind of forward thinking, because that's a big thing now too. It's like, especially in the recent couple of decades, like, yeah, big community focus, letting people, well, in terms of the more corporate entities, making fans feel important, at least for something like GIA, a fan site. Like, yeah, if you want to call it a fan site, it's going to have a fan element to it.
It was, yeah, it was, I mean, especially at the time, it was very, it was kind of bridging the gap between fan site and professional site.
Yes.
Because they would now, still, you know, they'd go to E3, they'd go to, was TGS around at the time?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. You know, they'd go to these shows and, you know, do actual coverage, which then made it very easy for all of them, including us, to then get picked up by actual game sites.
Yeah.
Because it's like, hey, we all have experience doing this.
Granted, the community stuff I was not really involved in. I was not interested in fan art or fanfics or anything. So
me neither, but I did like,
I was there mostly for the scoops.
I was there for the letters section as well. I do enjoy the letters.
Yeah, I know they did have some notoriety for their letters section. They had some people at the head of the letters section.
Yes,
writing back the commentary and stuff.
Our pal, I think was our pal Chris Jones was the last one to do it, who then contributed a Metroid 2 review to Cronk Games.
Yes, and some other things.
That's right.
So you mentioned this before. You found out from a forum post from Jeremy Parrish that the GIA was coming up, right?
Yes.
I have no idea how I found out about it. It might have been like a random IRC link from my usual
gang. I was just about to say,
something.
Yeah.
Probably just linking to a new story. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, my main IRC channel at the time was pound hashtag. What would I say for 90s context? Channel MU.
Okay.
But it was not the popular MU channel from EFNet. This was like on a completely different server network. And I think I found out about it first from Zofar's domain. So I think it was on.
Wow.
He was promoting it. And then I got into that version of MU. And that was basically my friend group on the internet for several years. And
boy, domain was a popular website name for nerds.
Yes. Well,
because that's probably where I got the idea, because Zofar is the main antagonist in Lunar 2, : Eternal Blue.
Big years for RPG villains to have domains. Yeah.
Oh, a lot of domains.
Boy, if you were an RPG villain, you were raking it in. Raking in the mindshare with the kids.
I showed up because I thought you said we were having low main. I get here and it's a bunch of villains? All right.
So yeah, I had an offshoot of MU, which was not the MU everybody mostly thought of, nor was I a part of Vidigames, which was a real central hub for a lot of the people who came up in game journalism. I think Andrew Vestal included, but also John Riccardi and Patrick Klepek, several other people who you and I know were hanging out in this Vidigames channel. I wasn't. I don't know why, but hey, at least I got in their circle one way or another.
I wasn't either.
Yeah, probably because I was on this completely different IRC network and was fine goofing around with my other friends or whatever. But yeah, maybe I was intimidated. Still sounds kind of intimidating when you have everybody who was somebody was hanging out in that channel. But no, I was in a very, very obscure sort of emulation channel. And so, yeah, probably someone posted a link to a GIA news post or something, and that's how I found out about it. And then later found out it was, you know, from the guy who did the Squaresoft homepage.
From three of the producers of Square.net.
But that's the thing, is that I wasn't very invested in it, because I wasn't like you. I wasn't hanging out on some other board for these sorts of nerds and found out about it from someone who's contributed. But I was just sort of came into it. But it did, like I said, become a very good spot for news and the Japanese videos and stuff like that, because I was also into Japanese RPGs and Squaresoft stuff and wanting to, you know, see all that stuff, because it was also like 98 to 2000, very formative for me, just like getting into Japanese culture and finally like doing things like importing games and downloading J-pop MP3s and all that. And that just sort of was a real good like dovetail. And all of that was
I think those
commercials.
The internet was instrumental in, I think, our respective weeb explosions. Because prior to the internet, it was just like, what did we have? Video game magazines? And that's kind of it. Like, that's our portal to Japan. And then suddenly there's news and screenshots and eventually commercials. Yeah, Game Fan especially.
Yeah, once the multimedia started to come into play, the videos and the MP3s and stuff, that was really the turning point. And that was really like, for me, especially, just like the actual mind expander was just like,
oh yeah,
getting all that stuff that I had been so interested in and didn't have any access to, and now having access to it and just consuming it day after day after day.
Yes.
Yes.
I was also still kind of in my anime phase, which wore off, I think, once I actually got to Japan. And I've heard this with other people as well, is I guess because a lot of the reason that I and other people watch anime is, ooh, it's this window into a completely alien culture. And then you come here and it's like, oh, I'm good now. I don't need to see any more of, some of it's still good. You know, some of it's still interesting, but for the most part, most anime is just like, I don't need this. I'm here now.
Yeah. Well, I think you came also at the right moment, at right age to just maybe start growing out of anime.
Yeah. There's also that.
I can only speak for myself. I was never that big into anime.
Yeah. Hey, before we get angry letters, shonen anime specifically.
Okay, sure.
Because we're going to get the actually anime as a medium people, which I know, but also no.
All right. Well, I'm not worried about that.
Okay. All right, fine.
I just wanted to say,
like, of course, animation as a medium is viable and beautiful, and Japan produces a lot of gorgeous stuff, but a vast, vast majority of it is shonen garbage, and that's what I'm talking about.
Okay. I think the masses have been quelled. You can settle down.
All right. Yeah. I hope
they're
so.
Lowering their pitchforks.
Okay. Ow!
Except that one guy. Yeah.
Ow! Is that a trident?
I was just trying to say that I explain, you know, how I'm in, I started getting into a lot of Japanese culture stuff, but anime was not that much a part of it. It really was just for me, like, video games, number one forever, or just coincidentally also a lot of popular music that I would find on just these pages that would just give you links to the whole MP3 album. And I'm like, okay, cool. I'll just put on my Rio.
Yeah. Rio!
And listen to that on the way to school, and even like associated with that, like video game soundtracks. But yeah, anime, not a huge thing for me. It was mostly being introduced to me from the IRC friends who were more into downloading series and subtitles as soon as they would come out and just sort of try and recommend things to other people, including me. And so I would see a couple of things here and there, and I would get stuff like volume one of Cowboy Bebop or volume one of Furikuri. And watch that and enjoy it, but yeah, not really feel the need to spend more money on it. I think the first anime thing I ever bought was like the Ranma 1/2 movie, the first movie.
Oh, wow.
But that was because I knew Ranma 1/2 from the Super Nintendo game. And I was interested enough in Ranma 1/2 that I finally wanted to see what that was all about. And so here I go ahead and get the VHS copy of the first movie, which where all the characters are established and assume that you know who they are. And I still kind of don't. But hey, it was a fun movie. Anyway, that was all a part of that whole late 90s thing and sort of, again, sort of reading the GIA as part of that. So yeah, the GIA was really cool, and there was a lot of just good JRPG coverage swinging around from that. And also before that, the Squaresoft homepage, and really Andrew Vestal was at the center of all that. Now, of course, he did get a lot of other people to join on for the GIA and help out with all the news and reviews and stuff. I think some people who would end up also just working with us, or us working for them, however you would want to put it at that point in time, because we were so green. But I think a lot of the people that Andrew Vestal was getting there were people that were closely like associated with his personality. Now, I mean this in a positive way. I'm saying that Andrew Vestal is a pretty smart guy. He's very learned.
Yes.
And also very literary. And I think one of the things that I sort of found out after joining the GIA and then even later, like working in other video game journalism aspects, like the people around me seem to read a lot more books than I have.
Oh yeah.
And I didn't really know how to deal with that. And so I think with the GIA, you have a lot of people who are really into like reading different kinds of fantasy novels, for instance, and just being like generally smarter than me on average. Nevertheless, we did make it in. You and that, I. I don't know about you. I don't know how read up you were as a teenager.
I was a very avid reader up through high school, even into college. It was actually, I think, because I'd never even heard of Haruki Murakami until Nick Marigos started talking about him. And I'm like, I read all of his books because I'm a nerd. Oh, the guy's got a Japanese name. Better read those.
Yes, I almost did. I was on the precipice of reading a Murakami book.
They're also very like – kind of like bizarre. Some of them are just bizarre postmodern. You bring the meaning to the story, I guess, which is, I don't know. I don't hate that. It's interesting sometimes.
I did read Boat Chan.
What the hell is Boat Chan?
From Natsume Soseki.
Oh, right. Okay. He's in the Phoenix, right?
Yes.
All right.
The man himself.
Yeah. But yeah, overall, they were a group of smarts, I think is the only way to put it. All these guys are... Just the fact that, like, what, Andrew went to Stanford? Just everyone was going to a good school. Meanwhile, I'm at Bethany College in a forest in West Virginia. I'm a fucking nobody going to a school for idiots. No offense, Brad. and then I transferred to Ohio University.
He's sitting there going, but we waited in line for the PS2 to get in. How could you?
Brad's holding a PS2 in my rearview mirror as I'm driving away. Sorry, Brad. Oh, I love you, buddy. And then I transferred to Ohio University, which is, I guess, a lateral move, really.
Yeah.
Because it's still not a great school. It was Playboy's number one party school for a long time. They do have the best, but they do have the best journalism program in the nation. And that's where I wanted to go to study. This is how dumb I was as a kid. I thought I had to go to journalism school to do video game journalism.
Yes.
I didn't even get into it. But yeah, everybody there was very smart. Everybody was very well read. And everybody, like it's, oh man, I don't know what it is. I don't know if this is an ADHD thing or what, or if I'm even, I don't know how my own brain works, but like, I can't do like music that is slow and quiet and doesn't have anything going on in it.
All right.
And I got,
what are we getting at?
I'm getting at like, there is, I think like to me, there is a subgenre of music for smart people and I don't like it.
Oh, okay.
And it's like, I like, every time
is it prog rock?
No, not even, because at least prog rock sometimes gets cool.
All right.
Like, I mean, Andrew would make these very cool mix CDs and send them out while we were in GIA and while he was in Japan. And like most, like a lot of the tracks are super good. A lot of it is just really cool J-pop. Like there's a lot of M-Flow on there, which I became a big fan of.
Yeah.
And Nick Marigos as well would make mix CDs. And we would send mix CDs to each other. And a lot of it was super good. And I discovered a lot of cool new artists. But like, I'd say like 20 to 30% of the tracks on those CDs were like, it's like the postal service. It's like, is this a song? What is happening? I know these are tones, but you can listen to this and derive pleasure. What is the secret? How do I do this?
Boy.
Why can I not be smart like you?
Sure.
Why do I not know how to enjoy this? Like, because I remember I bought Nick's iPod off him. He had a first generation iPod and he wanted to pick up the second gen when it came out. So I bought his first gen off him and he just left all the songs on it. And like a lot of it was super good. Like it was like every White Stripes album up to that point. I'm like, shit, this is really good. But then it was a lot of, it was also a lot of Postal Service. Like I hit play, right? What's going on? Fiona Apple, speak up? Stop whispering. It might be related to the fact that I hate the sound of whispering into a microphone. Whispering into a microphone fucking sets me off, and that's all Fiona Apple does.
All right.
I've never spoken about this out loud, but it's been sitting. It's been sitting in my brain for over two decades. I hate smart people music because it makes me feel dumb for not knowing how to enjoy it.
Okay, well.
And I will carry that to my grave. Give me a rock song. Give me a song. Not even a loud song. Like, even acoustic stuff is fine, but give me something that moves.
Just play a note.
Play a fucking note.
Or play like two notes, for God's sake.
It sounds like you went into a sewer with a rain stick and hit record. What are you doing?
Well, yeah, that was what they were praised for. I mean,
okay, all right, I guess that's true. I mean, that's largely
they won 18 Grammys.
Largely why I don't have a lot of patience for a lot of indie music, because I feel like a lot of it is like that. A lot of it is just, look how sensitive I am. Look how slow and quiet I can be without actually fucking doing anything. That's not fair. Mid-sentence, I realize I'm being very unfair to musicians. These are not genres I like, and it makes me feel dumb that I don't. And I'm glad I could finally get that out after 20 years.
Okay. Thank you for sharing.
Anytime.
I hear you. I understand you. I feel you.
Okay.
I never had that problem with music, though, necessarily. It was either just like, I'm into this or not. But I can go back to the fact that, yeah, the book stuff, like,
yes,
talking about different novels that I've just never heard of, like A Song of What in Fire?
Ice!
The What Tower? It's just
big!
Like, Ursula K. La Who?
That this also extends to graphic novels as well, because I know Andrew and Nick especially were very into a lot of comics, and it's how I found out about a lot of cool comics. But there's also a lot, again, the exact same thing. Like, I would read these comics based on recommendations and just feel like a fucking idiot, because I just throw my hands up like, I don't get it. Am I not smart enough for this? Now, granted, a lot of this was, I was still kind of in my, I divide my life into kind of three stages. Well, three main stages.
All right.
Like, stage one is up until I opened the bar. For 29 years, I was a teenager. I was basically
Nagoya, Japan.
Basically just a dumb fucking kid. Grew up in a bubble, kind of selfish, kind of ignorant about a lot of shit. Didn't really care about other people.
Yeah.
When I opened the bar, for the stage two is the first 5 years of the bar, where I started to make friends and I started to kind of come out of my shell socially, but then just fell real hard into drinking. And then stage three is 4 years ago to present, where I now have the presence of mind to know that I was not a good person. But also I don't drink anymore. So I now have the freedom to actually do the things I've always wanted to do. I basically have a enhanced perspective. And maybe if I went back and I tried to enjoy some of these books or comics or music again, maybe I would find new value in them.
Yeah, totally.
But all I remember, admittedly, this was in the shitbag stage of my life. I just remember feeling like a fucking idiot because I just couldn't get it. How does this person derive pleasure from this? It's driving me insane.
Yeah, I was largely the same way. And maybe that's why you and I get along so well.
I think so.
I feel like also like only in that first stage for so many years, I think maybe my stage two is like turning 35 and or also having a child. Like,
yeah, right. That's big.
Yes. But even right before my baby, it was just like, I do finally feel like I am mellowing out and feeling more mature just as a person, because I felt a lot like you back then, but really even more so into like as I turned 30. It's like, and even now I still have this, you know, this tingling feeling of like, I'm a rube. I really feel like a rube a lot of the time. Just like this total guy who's not had a lot of experiences with anything. Just
guy
sort
who's
of like
not had
adjacent
a lot of experience with anything.
Like sort of feeling like I'm just like a blue collar worker.
Yeah.
But even those guys know math.
Yeah.
I don't know what a fucking 8/16 of an inch is. But
it's like, that's half an inch, you idiot.
Oh, okay. I guess I can build that doghouse now. But
you got the dog 30 years ago. He's long gone.
You know, I was also selfish and stuff, but a lot of it, you know, like you, younger. And a lot of it's just because I've only really been interested in video games. It hadn't really broadened out. And, you know, I know that people tell you it's important to branch out and consume other media or read other things. And I think even like I heard some offhand thing like, you know, designers who get hired at Nintendo, like they have other interests or whatever. But I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'm not getting hired at Nintendo anytime soon.
Yeah, no,
I don't have a bonsai hobby, you know.
It is for real super important to have multiple interests. You can't just be a one interest person.
We can look at my interests and other things. I mean, we can pick out little things here and there, but nothing that I would call a secondary hobby or a secondary large interest. It's all things that I've mostly learned or glommed onto in service of my interest in video games. And so Crunk Games was a part of that, you know, learning more about web design or just editorial in general and graphic design for sure and Photoshopping and stuff like that. Looking back, and this is a show all about looking back, I just still feel like dumb.
Yeah.
And sort of wonder like, well, Jesus, at least again, like I said earlier, at least I was above average at writing and could appeal to someone looking for an above average writer. And that's how I got onto the GIA and then later into my freelancing and then went up and all that stuff.
My perspective about this stuff is always, I feel sometimes, like, especially when I'm writing or doing anything about video games, I often feel like, oh man, is this the only thing I know, really? But then you look at other people who make video game related content and you start to feel better. You start to feel like, oh no, I'm fine. I do have other skills and I do know other things. Like, I've said this before, and it's probably not a healthy thing to do, but like, if you ever need a quick, like, motivation boost, just go on YouTube, look for anybody's review of any video game, and the odds are it's going to be vapid. It's going to be not saying anything substantial. It's going to be boring. It'll give you the motivation. It'll remind you, oh yeah, I could do this real well. I just got to try a little bit.
What else can I say? But I agree with you. At least we weren't running the GIA.
No.
We had our own website to run after that.
That's right.
But the GIA did have a lot of smart people behind it.
Yes.
They should have called it the GI Type A.
Great.
Great. I'm just kidding. After we got on, we did make friends with those people and people who we still consider friends today.
Yeah, of course. I'm going to poke a lot of fun at Andrew and Nick and maybe Zach, but...
All right.
No, but let me finish the sentence.
I'm a nice guy.
In a friendly way.
Okay.
Like I did, man. I don't know if I want to admit this during the free episode. Like I did when I was still drinking. I like one night I was very very drunk, and I think I just DM'd Andrew like, "Hey man, I've always been intimidated by you. What's the deal?" He's like, "I don't know. What is the deal?
What is the deal?"
Yeah, and I was like, "I don't know. You got your shit together, and you're real smart." And he's like, "Well, you're doing all right too." I'm like, "Oh, I guess I am."
Oh,
and that was it. I felt like such an asshole.
Well, you know what? That will be the thesis of our series going forward. What's the deal?
No. Wait, I didn't finish my first sentence, which was, I'm going to poke fun at those guys. I still respect them. And I'm glad to know them. I'm.
Okay. Established. Good.
Yes. Thank you. Okay.
We're all grownups.
We are.
We're all grownups. We don't have any hangups. We will talk about old hangups maybe, but that's for another time. I think we got a good first prologue here ready to go. And so I think, that'll do it. Next time we will talk about actually me and Alex entering the GIA, the very beginnings of Crunk Games. After that, I think that's it. You feel good, Alex? Was that good? Was that good?
Anything else you want to mention? I think I yelled so hard that I'm bleeding.
Yeah, I am still getting over a cough, and I'm getting raspier by the minute.
But otherwise, yes, I'm good. This was a good start. Thank you for doing this.
Oh, okay, sure. You're welcome. No problem.
Let's keep doing it.
All right. Good.
All right.
Yeah. So this has been Game Site About Nothing, the Crunk Games podcast. This is our first prologue that we are letting everyone listen to as a preview of what we will have later on. So it'll be a part two of a prologue after this, and that'll also be for everyone to listen next time. But after that, it's all going to be exclusively on Patreon. Our Golder subscriber tier, $5 a month. We'll get you not only this show, the rest of this show, but our main show, No More Whoppers, a week early, ad-free, and even past access to gold in 60 seconds. 16 seconds. Take that again. Gold in 16 seconds.
16 seconds. 16 seconds.
That will about do it. It's going to be a fun ride and also maybe not so fun.
There's going to be drama.
There's going to be some drama. Listen, I'm going to be real with all of you right now, right at the end of the show. If you're wondering, Ray, this just sounds like a way for you to get your demons out. You're absolutely right.
Well, okay. Let mine out as well.
Yeah, Alex is here for the ride. This was a joint effort, this dumb website. And so I can't even talk about it properly without Alex with me.
I think it's fair because we were both, I think, very deep in our petulant child phases.
Absolutely.
So I don't think we should feel bad about letting all this stuff out because we've certainly moved on.
And that's also a good point about just being in your 20s, entering your 20s. Like, just because you're 20, 21, 22, 23 doesn't mean you've yet shaken off all of your teenage angst. And I think we will tell that story as we go on.
It took me about 35 years to shake it all off. Yes. And even now there's still residual anxiety. But at least now I know how to keep it in check.
Yeah, pretty much. Me too. That's what we're talking about. And so, that's it. Anything else would just be repeating what I already said. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Alex, for being here and continuing to be here. All right. That's been A Game Side About Nothing. We'll see you for Prologue Part 2 at some point in the future. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you then.
We stay up all night till morning, surfing online, browsing the pages. We'd strike gold if we dug deeper. Maybe a file, maybe a lyric. And the loading times were long, but we had time. Do you remember the websites? So wild and free, abundantly in the forums, where we would hang with Star Wars fans and we would chat on ICQ and on the walls on MySpace too. The list goes on.
Trident?